Today, I chat with Samantha McKay to understand the instincts, aka the subtypes, in the Enneagram personality type model. Hi, I'm Sandra.
And I'm Em.
And this is Family Personalities, the podcast that helps you create a more peaceful and compassionate family dynamic using personality type. I love the Enneagram for self-discovery and self-growth. Em and I first started talking about the Enneagram on this podcast pretty early on in episodes kind of like 4 through 8-ish. So if you don't know much about the Enneagram yet, you might want to go back and start with those episodes. You can also check out truity.com for a lot of articles on Enneagram, and Samantha, today's guest, actually writes for them, and her articles are all over their website. So that's a really good place to kind of start learning about Enneagram and maybe trying to figure out what your Enneagram type is. And today we're talking about the subtypes of Enneagram. And if you haven't heard about those yet, there are 27 subtypes, 3 subtypes for each of the 9 Enneagram types. So when you multiply 3 by 9, you get 27. And I invited Samantha on to tell us about them because personally, I have found them really clarifying and really helpful. They really can help with self-growth. They really pinpointed for me, even when I had my Enneagram type wrong, I found it really clarifying, but also it helped me discover actually that I was mistyped. I think they actually help you discover that you are mistyped, and they can be helpful if you're still trying to find your type as well. And I think they can be really, really, really helpful for self-growth, and they can help clarify why you might not look like other people of your Enneagram type, or why you might not exactly resonate with the generic type descriptions that are out there about your type. So this is something that I take a lot of personal interest in the Enneagram, and I hope that you find it as fascinating as I do. So I invited Samantha on to tell us all about the subtypes today. She is a qualified coach, trainer, and personality profiler. She calls New Zealand home after having lived, worked, and traveled all around the world. She has recently launched her personal development business, Individuo, which is a culmination of her career combined with her personal journey and search for answers from 10 years of chronic ill health. With Individuo, she aims to help others be healthy in all aspects of their being by taking an integrative approach to personal development and self-leadership, incorporating the frameworks such as the Enneagram and Myers-Briggs. There is so much in this episode that you're probably going to want to listen to it more than once. So we actually ended up recording a huge chunk of this episode twice because I had an internet connection issue, and so we lost a chunk of the recording and we had to re-record it. And so we had the conversation twice. And then on top of that, of course, I have to go back and edit it. And so I listened to it again. And so I, you know, heard what Samantha had to say 3 times now. And I'll probably go back and listen to it again after it's released. And so we'll hear it 4 times. Plus, I've heard all this information before when I've listened to like B and Uranio talk about it. Plus, I've, you know, read the book and I still feel like I will probably want to read it again and again and again because I find it so fascinating and interesting, and I pick up new information each time. And so this is probably an episode that you'll want to listen to over again, maybe twice, 3 times. I don't know. Maybe you're not obsessive like me. I don't know. Maybe not. So that being said, maybe we should just dive in and I should stop talking, but I'm so glad Samantha was here. It's a ton of information. She goes through it really fast. I really, really appreciate her taking the time to share all this great stuff with us. So that being said, let's just get into it. I'm so excited. Can you hear it in my voice? Can you hear how excited I am? Let's go. All right. Well, thanks for joining me. I kind of wanted to start with if you could kind of tell us how you got into Enneagram in the first place. And I don't think I know that story. So,
well, it's quite a long story. I realized it's very multi-layered. I feel like when you come into the Enneagram, it happens in steps and stages. And for me, my very first exposure was when I was working at a company on a contract doing some change management work. And they said, this is a company of sixes. Take that into account when you factor out how you change us. And I'm like, I don't know what sixes are. I have no idea what you're talking about. I don't know what that means. And I at that time, I took a test and went, oh, it looks like I'm a five, but that doesn't really resonate with me. And that was as far. I then just pushed the whole thing aside and left it for several years. And then when I was studying with Personality Hacker and their profile training, the Enneagram came up as part of that. And a friend of mine who is IEQ 9 certified sat down with me to help me figure out what my partner's type was at the time. Cause I'm like, oh, well, he seems like a two, he seems like a seven, but I can't quite figure it out. And it turned out he was a social nine. And that just opened my mind and this doorway to seeing the power the Enneagram can help you with relationships and just seeing how the body types communicate in such a different way and how that social drive, particularly for a nine, means they show up entirely differently. And it really answered quite a number of the questions I had about things in our relationship that I couldn't quite wrap my head around. And I think that was the real doorway into it for me. And then I started doing it through my work and I took this program with CP Enneagram, their skills training class, which I have this habit of leaping into things I don't fully understand and what the outcomes of them are, which is how I leapt into my coach training 10 years ago. I was like, oh, this sounds interesting. I'm like, oh, I'm becoming a coach. Okay. I hadn't realized that was what was happening. And then I took this course.
Maybe it's an appropriate time to share what your Enneagram type is so people understand.
I'm a self-preservation seven and an ENTP. So there's a lot of leaping without looking that happens at times. And yeah, so the same thing happened. I was like, okay, I need a really solid foundation, the Enneagram, to continue my work in it. I'll take this skills class because my work is mostly at this point in education and training. And yeah, it turns out the whole class was for coaches and therapists. And I was like, oh, this wasn't what I expected, but this is fascinating. And then I signed up for the whole 2-year program. And then I've just been in a deep dive with Enneagram ever since. And now I'm in this endless rabbit hole of Enneagram that I'm absolutely loving. And it's not just helpful for me, but just seeing how practically helpful it can be for other people with the people I'm coaching as well. It's just fascinating.
Okay. I realize this might take us down a rabbit hole, but can we back up a minute? What you said your significant other is a nine, and body types, it helped you understand how body types communicate. How do body types communicate?
Ah, yeah. With their bodies, with action. Oh. So you've got body types, heart types, and head types. So the body types are eight, nines, and ones. The heart types are twos, threes, and fours. And the head types are five, six, and sevens. And so the heart types, you know, they communicate with feelings. They're focusing on their emotional intelligence. How do I connect with people? The head types are all about thoughts and analysis. And so they communicate with words a lot. And so I would ask questions like, well, can you take me through step by step how you lit this fire? He was a sensor. How did you light this fire? So I can follow the steps to produce it because I'm an intuitive. I don't naturally see. And he was like, I just do it. It's just instinctual. It just comes to me. I just look at it and I respond. And just understanding that it's very kinesthetic intelligence. It's very just instinctual. There is a sense in the body about what the right next step is and they just do it. And that really clarified something for me because I was just all about, well, we can put it into this process and this framework and I explain that step by step to you and then, you know, we'll be on the same page. And it just didn't work that way. And I think I have quite a few body intelligent or kinesthetic intelligent led people in my life. And that really helped clarify, you know, the differences. You know, you're not seeing necessarily a lot of emotional expression, but you're seeing a lot of action and getting into action and helping very quickly in that way.
Okay. And what's his Myers-Briggs type, your partner?
Ex-partner, but he was an ESFJ.
Oh, okay. Okay. Interesting. Okay. Sorry. Side note. And So, and then, and are you doing kind of any work with Enneagram now, or just still trying to finish out the training, or?
No, no. So as part of the program, you have to demonstrate your ability to use it in the real world. So I've been running training sessions, I've created videos, I write a lot of articles, and I'm also working one-on-one with coaching clients, which is just amazing. So once you know someone's type and subtype, you then coach them. I adapt my coaching style to suit their type. And then we have these assessment factors. And so we have this assessment session, which you present your particular challenge. And then through a series of questions and, you know, intuition, I go, okay, so this seems like the primary assessment factor, the primary part of your personality we should focus on. And so I'm not just going, okay, you're a four, so we're going to work on your emotions or being practical. It's actually, okay, which part of the four do we need to focus on? Is it an arrow? Is it a wing? Is it a subtype? Is it an advanced subtype? Is it part of just the passion or the fixation? It's getting really specific so that then that person is working on exactly the thing they need to be working on right now in a style that really suits them.
Yeah.
And it's really powerful to see it in action.
So does someone come to you with like, I'm having this like real world problem, like, and then, you know, type me and help me figure that out? Or is it more just like, you know, here's my type and like, I want to grow generally, or what does that look like usually?
It could be either at this point in time. Actually, I've had a mix of both, to be honest. But yes, generally I will do a typing session first, even if they know their type, because the typing interviews give you a really great understanding of yourself and you're answering questions you haven't answered before. And it helps me see a lot about where a person's at, and it gives someone a lot of things to think about as well. And then we do the assessment session, and then we focus on the coaching program from there. So I'm working with someone at the moment on being less self-critical. And
I don't have any problems with that.
And increasing their self-acceptance and self-compassion, which in some ways sound like really simple things, but, you know, for particular types, those are really, really huge challenges.
Yeah. Nothing's resonating there at all. Okay, so today I really wanted to talk to you about subtypes. Okay, help me out with the terminology right now. For some reason, I was like using the word instinct and subtype as the same thing, but am I getting that wrong? Is instinct something completely different?
It's same, but different. And so it's an easy confusion point for people. So the instincts refer to, in the Enneagram's case, three survival drives that we all have. And the subtype refers to when you take the instinct and you combine it with the passion at the center of each type.
Oh boy. Okay. My brain works slowly these days.
I understand. Trust me. So the instincts are self-preservation, social and sexual, and we all have those drives, and animals have those drives as well. I mean, we all have other survival instincts as well, but all of us have those drives. The difference is that animals will just express them reasonably naturally. Mammals, or those of us with complicated brains, one of them will take over and start to be the dominant instinct.
Sandra, I just heard Bill Burr's rant saying how women should be supporting female athletes and not Real Housewives who just yell at each other.
That's ridiculous. Real Housewives is a sport. Join us on From the Bleachers, where we analyze the strategy and gameplay that our favorite reality stars use to earn additional seasons of play and social media fame.
And if you're lucky, Sandra will pull out her apology play rubric so you can all see what an easy grader I am.
I'm sorry, Mandy, but if you think Monica's apology to Heather on Salt Lake City deserved anything over a 2.5, you're delusional.
Whether we're breaking down confrontation play, relishing the bravo, bravo, bravo moments, or awarding a tardy for the party, we are the only place you'll find in-depth analysis of the plays that your favorite housewives are making on our screens.
From the Bleachers, a Real Housewives game analysis is available everywhere podcasts live. Okay. So I think I am understanding it correctly. So we have one of three instincts. And say them again. What are the three?
Self-preservation, social, mm-hmm. and sexual, or one-to-one. Some people refer to mm-hmm. it that way.
Yeah. Yeah. So my co-host, who unfortunately couldn't join, is a sexual or one-to-one four, but she hates the word sexual. And so I have to ask in her stead, why do they call it sexual?
Fair enough. I don't know if I have the absolute etymology definition of where that came from, but sexual refers to that instinct of, you know, wanting to bond with a significant person. Mm-hmm. And so it's not about sex per se, but it is that drive to be close to someone. But it's also the instinct that gives us the greatest access to anger and our vital energy. And so all the sexual dominant types mm. tend to have more energetic vibrancy than some of mm. the other types. And so they can be more competitive, more passionate, more aggressive, more intense, that mm. you know, and so the sexual, like, word as a concept kind of encapsulates that complexity a little better than one-to-one does.
Mm. Okay. Gotcha. Yeah. She's not a big fan of that. Okay. So there's the three instincts. And then I guess, and then the subtype is just when you apply those three instincts to one of the nine numbers.
Yeah. When you blend it with the passion at this, or the emotional distortion at the center of each Enneagram type. Okay. And so for the four, you take envy and you combine it with the sexual instinct. That looks very different when you take envy and combine it with the social and then with the self-preservation instinct.
Okay.
They all right. come so up very differently.
Right. Gotcha. Okay. So can we go into the three instincts?
Absolutely.
And can you talk about each one and what they are?
Definitely. So let's start with self-preservation, or conservation, as some people call it. But self-preservation is focused on protecting and taking care of our bodies in some way. So in its sort of natural, you know, non-distorted form, it's putting on a jumper when we're cold, eating when we're hungry, going to the bathroom when we need to, making sure we have enough money to have a roof over our heads and to sort of have those material resources to be comfortable in some way. So there's a sense of, I want to take care of my body and I want to be comfortable. But when that's a dominant instinct, it means that we unconsciously believe our life is permanently threatened. So we tend to be more risk averse, more anxious, more introverted, more pragmatic, more self-sufficient, more skeptical than we see in the other combinations. And so you can see how if someone's got that as a dominant instinct, that's going to really shift the flavor of their life and what they focus on and what they value. And even in how that reflects in our Myers-Briggs type. So more extroverted types are going to appear more introverted.
Mm. Okay. That's interesting. Yeah. And I could see how maybe like an Enneagram type that maybe comes off as more of more extroverted Enneagram type might be more introverted. Aren't you a self-preservation seven, you just said? And sevens tend to be more like extroverted out in the world. Do you feel like you are more of an introverted seven?
Absolutely. Yeah, very much so.
Interesting.
I've also spent a lot of time living at five. And so I've had a lot of introverted time as well. But I spent yesterday fully in meetings all day. And by the end of it, I was just drained, you know? What I also find really interesting about the instincts is your dominant instinct gives you a lot of energy. So I get a lot of energy from organizing things. A social person is going to get a lot of energy from spending a day at a conference, and a sexual person is going to get a lot of energy from spending the weekend with someone they love, you know, that one person who's super important to them. And so, yeah, I love spending time with people and I love, you know, all the work I do, but at some point I'm going to need some introversion time just because I don't get the energy from that in a way other people do.
Yeah. And now I'm thinking of my husband, who's an INTJ. He's an Enneagram 5 and he's self-preservation. And so you've got like the super, 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 super introvert.
Super introvert. Yep. Absolutely. That's just like all the helpings of introversion all in one place.
Yep. That tracks. Great.
So let's talk about the social instinct. So in its, you know, normal, like non-distorted state, it's that desire to belong to a group, to serve the group in some way, to serve our community and to be recognized for our service. And, you know, all of us can do that in some form. It's that sense of belonging. when that's a dominant instinct, it becomes a need to be important to the group in some way, to have a role in some form. And so people with that as a dominant instinct tend to seek out leadership roles. They want to be more influential. They can be more political. They can worry about their social image and want approval and recognition from the group. And they can pay more attention to the group than to individuals.
Okay. Got it.
And then the sexual or one-to-one is about bonding, having, you know, strong bonds with individuals that are important to us, you know, the best friend, our partner, whatever form that takes. But, it's a desire to sort of have that with, in a way, with, it's not just one person, but it's, you know, one person that's very important to us. As a dominant instinct, we start to believe that other person is everything, that they are more important than anything else. And so when with someone who has this dominant instinct, they tend to be more impulsive, seductive, competitive, persuasive, intense. They have a lot of energy. There's a desire to have a lot of impact.
Okay. What does that look like for someone who's single?
A best friend, you know, could be having a very important friendship. It's not necessary to be a business partner. It's not specifically about it's not romantic. The drive isn't romantic love. It isn't about producing children per se. It's about having a one-to-one connection with someone.
Okay. Interesting. So now I'm wondering, are we born with these instincts?
It's hard to prove, but that's the general perspective.
Okay.
I know there are various schools of thought, but having worked with Beatrice Chestnut and Urania Pies for a while and seeing their perspective on why we're not just born with them, but gestate with them, can see how they actually have, that's almost genetic in a way. So you hear, I've seen work done with sexual nines, and sexual nines as a whole really merge with another person and forget themselves. And if they had a twin in the womb who either lived or died, that they can have merged with that other person's type, and it actually became hard to determine their own type because they've actually merged with their twin in utero.
Oh, wow. That's fascinating.
It is fascinating, but a rabbit hole we won't go down, but just giving you an example of why how even we're seeing the world through the lens of our type, even before we're born.
Yeah. And then how can we figure out what our subtype or our instinct is? Like, is it better to figure out your instinct first and then find your Enneagram number? Or do you want to find your Enneagram number first and then drill down to the instinct or subtype?
Neither are the way, unfortunately. Okay. There is no way but through, because there are so many things that look alike, and there's so many things that cross over. So it's almost trying to find both at the same time, which is really challenging. So I did a typing session with someone yesterday who appeared to be a sexual dominant, you know, because she had this, got a lot of energy from spending time with her friends. But in the end, it looked like she was social dominant. But that was only clear when we found she was an eight. And so it was really it was the type and the subtype together that explained things. Whereas if I was just looking at the...
She looked like sexual dominant until you realized maybe it was the eight that had that sexual energy.
The eights have that excessive energy, but it was more recognizing how eights show up generally and then seeing how that mixes.
Gotcha.
Because some eights can be very five-ish. You know, they can be very introverted and withdrawn because they don't, you know, especially the self-preservation eights, they don't need to talk about things to get something done. They just do it. They don't need to communicate about it. It's like, right, let's just get into action. The social eight is really mellow and friendly and mentors people and really wants to protect the defenseless, you know, the weak and unprotected in some form, you know. So you know, think animal shelters and women's refuges, you know, that sort of really strong desire to protect. And in that particular session, that was a stronger theme than the sexual eight, which is I want to almost be the center of attention and sort of magnetize the room in a way.
Okay. Yeah. I can see how once you got to the type, then it made more sense. Okay. Well, why don't we go through all the Enneagram types and then you can tell us what each subtype looks like for each of the Enneagram types so we can kind of get a little taste of what the different flavors are.
Yeah, let's do that. Absolutely. And I'll let you know as we go through which subtypes can be confused for either other types or other subtypes as well. That can be useful to understand because there is quite a lot of confusion and it can be really hard to see beneath the surface at our own drivers. It can actually be really challenging to see our own subtype in action. I think sometimes we often choose or want to see ourselves as a different subtype before we're ready to see ourselves as our actual subtype.
Okay.
A little bit easier on the ego.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. So, where do you want to start?
I'll start with the body types. We'll do eights, nines, and ones first.
Okay.
Because in some way, all the body types are interested in order and congruency and fairness in some way and a desire to control the environment around them in some form. But it varies depending on what those drivers are. So with the eights, we know that the passion or the core driver is known as lust or excessiveness. You know, it's it can be having excessive energy or just, you know, expressing that in some way. So with the self-preservation.
I'm really curious about eights because my dad is an eight and I haven't pinned down his subtype yet.
Okay. Well, the three eights, again, look quite different.
Okay.
So the self-preservation eight actually can look quite five-ish because they don't need to explain themselves very much. They just get into action very quickly. They're very self-contained and they just have like – they can take impact. They just want to have impact really quickly. So they don't need to ask for help. They just do something. They also are really focused on their own comfort and want to have material resources to ensure they're going to be comfortable. And they will pay a lot of attention to their physical comfort in situations. It'll be like their first priority before they can focus on other things.
Would this be like material comforts? I'm trying to.
Yeah, so it's more physical comfort. So when you take a, you know, body types are more interested in the body, self-preservation is more interested in the body. And so it's the how can I be comfortable? So a self-preservation eight in a bar might be focused on finding the most comfortable chair before they'll be willing to get into a conversation with someone.
Okay.
That sort of thing. The social eight is quite different. Again, they're really mellow and friendly and then can often be confused as a two or a nine. They really focus on mentoring and supporting others and really focused on protecting the weak in some way. And so that can be, you know, animals in animal shelters or women's refuges or just anyone who can't really defend themselves. The social eight wants to get in there and protect.
Okay.
And then the sexual eights are really passionate and charismatic and emotional and sensual, and they really use their energy to magnetize a room. And they can be a little more focused on power and control and really wanting to be the center of attention than the other eights. Mm-hmm. And so they can be confused for sexual fours because, again, they have greater access to anger. But for eights, that anger comes out as energy. Eights don't see themselves as angry in the way other people do. They just see themselves as energetic and expressing that energy because they have so much of it.
We have a running joke in my household that I don't think my dad thinks is that funny because growing up, he'd always be like, I'm not angry when my dad would be, when my mom would be like, stop yelling or stop. My dad would be like, I'm not yelling. You are yelling. You seem very angry right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that can be really confusing. And eights are actually quite prone to being bullied, and not many people realize it. They think that just because an eight projects this sense of strength and that they have easy access to anger, that they won't be bullied. In fact, actually, eights can be bullied quite a lot. And so that's something that people can get tripped up about with our understanding of eights, because we stereotypically think of them as strong and direct. And so we can be, you know, almost too direct back with them, but they're really sensitive. And so if you want to give an eight some direct feedback, you need to do it in private. That's not to say don't be direct and transparent, but don't be rude and don't expose them or expose their weaknesses or their tender spots to anyone in any way.
Yeah. I feel like maybe my dad's the self-preservation. I wonder if that runs in family. I feel like I have so much self-preservation going on in my family. I wonder if that's like a, is it hereditary?
I don't know. I have to say, I don't know. I don't think the research is there yet, but
okay.
I do see themes, but I suspect some of my family is self-preservation, but I don't think they all are.
Okay.
Okay, so let's shift to nines. So nines, the core driver is known as sloth, which is really around self-forgetting. They distract themselves from their core being in some ways. They merge in three different ways. They sort of don't want to separate in some form, and so they forget about themselves. Mm-hmm. So the self-preservation nines merge with comfortable routines. Again, it's that focus on physical comfort, and that can include things like food and television and puzzles and wanting to have their coffee at the same time every day and needing to do things at the same time every day. That sense of routine can be really important. And they want to have a comfortable chair. They want to have comfortable clothes. The comfort is really important to them. But unlike other nines, they can be a little more irritable, a bit more stubborn, and more practical. So they can have a sense of an eightishness to them, but they're still very nine-ish in that sort of form.
Okay.
So social nines are very different and can be confused as twos and threes because they can be workaholics, and people don't always appreciate that nines aren't lazy. It's one of the stereotypes that nines are like. They're not. They're working very hard, just not on anything that pertains to themselves. So social nines want to belong to as many groups as possible, and they work really hard to try and belong to those groups, but they never really feel like they belong. So they have this underlying sense of sadness that really propels them. So they work really hard, but never really feel like they get there with that sense of belonging.
Okay.
I know. I feel really sad, don't you? I feel so sad. Just like, oh, you just want to go and hug everyone after this.
Yeah.
Sexual nines merge with another person, so much so that they forget their own feelings, their own values, their own attitudes, their own opinions. They really mimic their partner instead. And they have to work really hard to try and find themselves in relationships, spending more time alone in order to determine what their own opinion or perspective or even, feeling is. They're the most emotional of the nines and can look like twos, threes, and fours.
Okay. That made me think of something when you were saying that nines, which subtype was it that you said can sometimes look like eights?
The self-preservation nine.
Self-preservation nine can sometimes look like eights. That made me think that someone might say, well, what's the difference between subtypes and wings? Is that just a nine wing eight?
Good question. There's a bit of confusion about that because I've come to understand through this study that wings are not subtypes, and that the belief in wings as subtypes is a sort of one of those historical distortions about how the Enneagram theory has evolved over the last several decades. And so, in fact, wings are resources for growth. And so if we just focus on trying to find which wing we are, we can often get stuck trying to find our type as opposed to getting to the Enneagram's true purpose, which is how do we grow out of our personality? You know, if our personality is a mask, how do we work at leaving it behind so we don't need it to survive anymore? Instead, letting it go. And so instead of seeing wings as a subtype, it's to see wings as just resources for growth and seeking to drawing on them for help. So I'm a self-preservation seven. We can look a little more six-ish because that self-preservation is fear-based. And so we can have more anxious. We can do more of that over planning and contingency planning for things. And in one area of my life, I do it extremely strongly, but not really anywhere else. I can also look a bit eight-ish because the seven, self-preservation seven, has a drive to get what they want, to be opportunistic, to take advantage of things. And so you can see the wings represented in each subtype, but really the drive is coming from the instinct, that need to survive, which is so powerful. We don't get to think about our instincts. They just happen. They are actions that emerge. They are just super instinctual. You can only think about them after they've happened. You're like, oh, I didn't really expect to do that, but look, I just did it again.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's tricky. It's tricky because a lot of people have come to think of wings as subtypes, but if you think of it technically, this is a bit technical, but really at the heart of each Enneagram type is the emotional passion, that emotional distortion. And if wings were subtypes, it means we're saying that we're a mix of multiple passions, which would actually make our psychology very confusing and very tough to deal with. And what we actually see is that we don't have multiple passions. We have a passion and an instinct that have blended together in some way.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. We're not multiple Enneagram types. We're just one. Yeah, that's always resonated with me when I've, listened to what Bea and Aranio have to say about that. Mm. Yeah.
And then we have the ones. Now, their core driver is around anger, but it can also be translated as a desire to be perfect, expressed in three different ways. So the self-preservation one tries to be perfect, but never feels like they achieve it. And so they can look like perfectionists to other people, but they will, but they wouldn't necessarily describe themselves as perfectionists because they know they're never perfect. It's that unattainable sense of perfection.
Yeah. Now this is the type that I related to for 3 years that now I'm thinking I might not be, but okay, go on.
So they take their anger and turn it into warmth and friendliness. And so they can have a real softness to them, but they are very self-critical and can have a lot of worry and anxiety. So they can be mistaken for self-preservation sixes because of that worry and anxiousness can be a little more obvious than with the other types. I know a few self-preservation ones and an INFJ self-preservation one. And it's, interesting to see when we talk about ones in their growth path, often we're telling them to get worse, to stop trying to improve themselves, which is such a hard thing for them to do.
Yeah.
The social one is perfect. So they figure out what the right way is to do something and they just do it that way. They become role models of perfection. So they're not as worried about being perfect as the self-preservation one because they know what the right way is. They know the perfect way to do it and they just do that. But that does make them a little less open to change, a little less adaptable to hearing other perspectives or understanding why people would do things differently. But given that they know the right way to do things, they often act as teachers, educating and role modeling the right way to do something to others. And they can look a little five-ish in that sense that they can be a bit more intellectual and a little cooler in how they come across.
Okay.
And then the sexual ones want to perfect others. This is often, we call these the reformers because they want to improve other people in the world around them. So they find it a little bit easier to get in touch with their anger than the other ones and can be more critical of others than of themselves. They still have that inner critic, but it's not necessarily as strong as what you'd see with the self-preservation one. They tend to be a bit more assertive, and so they can be confused with eights.
I think these are the ones that I have trouble with because I'm very sensitive to criticism. And I don't like it when anyone tries to tell me what to do or how to be.
Yeah, it's really interesting because a lot of types are very sensitive to criticism. You know, twos are very sensitive to criticism. They need a lot of positive feedback. Ones are very sensitive to criticism, but they just think people are criticizing them all the time. You know, sevens are sensitive to criticism because they're avoiding pain, you know. So generally there is a sense of, you know, no one really likes criticism because it hits us in some way. But think of it as what you're seeing as criticism is coming through your lens of what is critical to you. So what a one sees as critical could be different as to what a three or a seven sees as critical. So there are things that like I would dismiss. I'm like, oh, that's not critical at all. But when it hits the sore spot, you're like, oof, that's a bit much. And so in my typing interviews, when I ask people about their inner critic, I listen to what that inner critic says because that actually tells me, indicates what type they might be. And ones have a very specific type of thing their inner critic says that others don't share.
Okay. Interesting.
Should we move on to the heart types?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. So the twos, threes, and fours see themselves through the eyes of their relationships and they get concerned about having approval, recognition, and connection with other people in some way. Now, for twos, that core driver is known as pride, which is actually a form of seduction using three different ways to draw people towards them in some form to sort of help them meet their needs. So the self-preservation two is more like the teacher's pet. They are charming and cute and friendly. And what they're trying to do is find an adult to take care of them. They almost see themselves as a bit of a child who's not quite grown up. And so they can be a little more anxious, but they can also be more playful and they're very sensitive to rejection and can be easily hurt. Now, they can look a little four-ish and they can also look a little six-ish.
What makes them look a little four-ish?
That emotionality, because twos can have really big emotions that they express very loudly at times. The social two is more ambitious because this is about seducing groups. And so they can be that powerful, influential leader who strategically gives to get. So they can appear very generous, but be very ruthless internally. And so they work really hard. They are very competent. And so they can appear like eights or threes.
Okay.
Which is really not what we expect for a two. You know, we don't think of twos in that lens. And then the sexual twos really want to seduce another person, aiming to be the best partner they've ever had. So then that person will do whatever that they want them to do. So they are very, that seductive force of nature, wild and confident and emotional, but can experience intense anguish when a relationship ends. So they can look a little or be confused for a sexual four.
None of those pictures of the two is what you think of when you think of a two.
Absolutely not.
At least not like the conventional picture that I get in my head of a two.
No, because the stereotype of a two is that kind, helpful, caring, generous person who will selflessly bend over backwards for you. Mm-hmm. And yet there's a lot of strategicness to the drive for the two and that sense of pride. And pride is actually a really tricky passion to work with and to see it in action. And twos can struggle to almost determine which of the subtypes belongs to them because none of them match that outer ego sense of how they're projecting themselves.
Yeah. And that's what's so tough about the Enneagram is I think when you're first introduced to it, like, you know, it's very positive pictures of all of the eight types. And then what it really is underneath is it's tough. I mean, all of them, it's a tough picture of what's really happening at the core when you're in personality. It's really kind of facing the darker side of yourself.
Very much so. Very much so. Yeah. So let's look at the threes that core drivers around.
Ooh, do we have to?
I'm so sorry, but we do. that core drive is around self-deceit or vanity, and each three deceives themselves in a different way. Three different ways of achieving in order to do so. So the self-preservation three deceives himself as being a good person for not having vanity. Mm-hmm. And they are more modest, more shy. They don't brag about their achievements and they're very hardworking. They can be some of the biggest workaholics on the Enneagram at times. So they can be confused for ones and sixes because of that drive for goodness and to demonstrate that they don't have any vanity.
So that's the one that I'm trying on right now that I think might fit with me. And yeah, it's hard. I feel like there's that. I've been trying it on. I think I recognize that dance that I do between like trying to show up as this person who I just want people to see me in this certain way, but and like kind of like show people this this person who is all these things, but not, you know, trying to take too much credit for it, but taking a little bit of credit for it, but not taking, you know what I mean? Like I feel like I do this dance all the time, and just starting to recognize some of that in myself. It's been interesting
journey. As you start to see the different elements of the subtype description start to open up to you.
Yeah.
It certainly hasn't been something that I instantaneously saw in myself. I've only just started observing this sense of like opportunism that the self-preservation seven has, which we'll talk about shortly.
Okay.
The social three is the more stereotypical three, the one who works really hard, looks really good, gets the job done, has that, you know, loves being center stage, loves the applause, wants to have the corner office. They're competitive. They're good at sales and just, you know, being big and loud and out there and successful in that traditional sense. And so
I feel like that's the three I want to be. I feel like that three has a lot more energy than I do.
Well, we all have energy in different ways. You definitely have a lot of energy for getting things done, for achieving your goals.
I feel like I wish I had a lot more.
But it's the where the energy aligns around the goodness.
Maybe.
So social threes can be confused for eights because they appear to have that same similarity because threes push their emotions away in order to be productive. And so they're actually some of the most emotional types on the Enneagram, but people don't think they are because they often don't necessarily appear as empathetic as you'd expect for a heart type, but they're just pushing all that sadness away in order to look like they're performing and winning in some form.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then the sexual threes focus on other people's success. So they're supporting and cheerleading of others. They are focused on having their approval in those relationships and making sure the people that they're supporting are giving them that feedback and that positive feedback and are often sweet and shy and emotional. So they can look a little more like twos or a little more like sevens.
Okay. I can see the twos, how that might look like a helper if you're bringing someone else up. You know.
Fours. So the 3-4s actually look quite different. And that can be very confusing for people. So the core driver is around envy, and that leads them to suffering in 3 different ways. So the self-preservation 4 don't express their feelings. They are stoic and masochistic, and they work really hard to get what they're lacking. They go into action to get that, and they appear happy. They earn love by smiling and working hard and not complaining. That's sort of the message they got from childhood. So they can look like 1s, 3s, 5s, and 7s.
That sounds confusing.
Yeah, it's also one of the least sort of well understood subtypes on the Enneagram because it's so different from the traditional or the stereotypical understanding of the 4.
Okay.
And so I think there's quite a few people who don't realize that they might actually be a self-preservation 4. And you know, confused in some way just because it's not well understood.
Okay.
The social 4 is the more stereotypical 4. So they over-identify with their feelings and share those feelings in a form that can sound like complaining to other people, but to them it's just pointing out things that are missing. So they earn appreciation through their suffering. They compare themselves to others and find themselves inferior or worse off in some way.
I think I might be raising a social 4. I think my 6-year-old is a social 4.
Okay. There's
so much envy there. So much envy.
All right.
Yeah. She's also an ISFP. So I'm like, I don't know if I'm just seeing a lot of introverted feeling or there's a lot of feelings. There's a lot of envy. It's a lot.
And sexual 4s make others suffer. So they are assertive and demanding and express their anger more than the others. And so they see others as the cause of their suffering. So they can be competitive. They try to be special and extraordinary to attract a partner. And when they compare themselves with others, they can see themselves as superior, not inferior in the way the social 4 does. So 3 very different kinds of presentations around the 4 there.
Okay. And Emma's going to have to, when she listens to this episode, we'll have to do a reflection, my co-host, because she thought she was a sexual 4, but I'm seeing her more in the social 4. So we'll have to see what she says after this.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So the sexual 4s can be confused for 8s because of that expression of anger. And I think that's one of the challenges. Any type that expresses anger well seems to get lumped into the 8 category. But that's not always the actual underlying driver.
All right. Now we got to do the head types, huh?
Head types, yes. My favorite place to hang out in the Enneagram.
Yeah, I'm married to one of those. I'm pretty sure my son's a head type, but I haven't identified which head type he is yet.
Okay. All right. So the 5, 6s, and 7s see the world as unsafe and aim to keep themselves safe by anticipating danger and creating certainty, as well as testing things, testing out to see, is this safe? Is this not safe? So for 5s, the core driver is known as avarice, which is sort of 3 different ways of protecting or holding on to their resources in some form, trying to compartmentalize things in a way. So the self-preservation 5 takes that really literally and creates really strong boundaries that they kind of want to stay behind, minimizing their needs as much as possible. So they sort of almost
this
have
this is a, my husband right here.
Yeah. So
let's break him down.
So he probably has an office where everything he needs is in that office. He could live in there for several weeks. He locks the door. I prefer no one comes in.
Tell me more.
But they can also be very warm and friendly. I think sometimes when we portray the self-preservation 5 in that way, it makes them seem cold and withdrawn, but they're actually warm and friendly. They just need regular alone time to process their thoughts and feelings privately and need to know when it's safe to emerge from their little sanctuary.
Yeah, people are actually often surprised at, you know, when I talk about how introverted my husband are, when they meet him, you know, at a party, they're like, oh no, he's super friendly and outgoing, but it's just that it's on his terms.
Yes.
Right. Like absolutely. He can come out on his terms, but then he will go safeguard his own energy for like the other 23 hours of the day.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've spoken to 5s who, when I ask them, you know, in social situations, you know, are you more outgoing or, you know, just sit back and watch? And they're like, well, I'm outgoing because I only hang out with people I want to hang out with.
Mm, yes.
So there's no need to sit back because I'm with the people I want to, you know, spend my energy on.
Yes. Yeah.
So it's the social five that can appear a bit cooler because they're very intellectual. They use knowledge to keep people at a bit of a distance. So they will still have a room in which they can hide away and lock the door, but they love to talk about what they know with people who share those interests. They want to see themselves as a bit of an expert, potentially more of an expert than some of the other fives do. And they have a real fear of life being meaningless. So they have a series of ideals or super ideals that they share with other people. So because they're so chatty in social environments, they can sometimes be seen as sevens because it's just I'm passionate about this thing.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
And then the sexual fives are in search of the ideal relationship. They want someone they can share their full inner world with. And yet they're waiting for other people to open up to them first before they open up. And so they can struggle to get that ideal relationship.
Mm-hmm.
They are more connected to their feelings than the other five. So sometimes they can confuse themselves as fours, but to other people, they still appear very five-ish.
Mm. Okay.
They are artistic and express their emotions in some form of art, you know, painting, writing music or poetry or, you know, some other form of creative expression.
Oh, okay. That's interesting. Yeah, I wouldn't think of that as a five. You know, you think of them as like purely informational.
Mm, absolutely. But they're not all that way.
Okay. Neat.
Right. The sixes, their core driver is around fear. And each subtype reacts to fear in a different way. So the self-preservation six, the fear manifests as an insecurity and doubt and a worry. So to keep themselves safe, they seek friendly alliances and protectors. Now to do that, they are warm and friendly, even though they're also anxious and doubting, and they question everything. They'll even question their own questions. So if you ask them a question, they'll reply with a question, which I know drives some people crazy. But they're also constantly questioning themselves. And so they see everything in shades of gray. And because of that warmth and desire for people around them, they can look like twos or nines.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I have a couple of people in my life that I would put in this that are probably in this Enneagram subtype.
Mm. Yeah, I don't think I have actually a lot of sixes in my life. So this is one of the types and subtypes I really want to get more familiar with and spend more time with.
Mm.
The social six wants to find a good authority or an ideology with clear rules that they can just follow. That's how they stay safe. If they know the rules, they follow the rules, they will remain safe in some way. Now, that authority can be a person, it can be an ideology, it can be a system. But because they're following those rules in some way, they are more dutiful, more responsible, more intellectual. And as long as they know the rules, they can relax. So they don't have that same experience of doubt as the self-preservation six does, but they're still assessing and planning scenarios in the way that all sixes do.
Okay.
Now, at times, the social six can actually be a bit too certain, a bit too black and white. And so they can look a little more like ones because of that or threes.
Okay.
And so they don't necessarily find it as hard to get into action as the self-preservation six would.
So this be like, maybe like a someone who like seeks out religion or something like that is something.
Could be religion. It could be science. It could be a, you know, what we might term as a guru. It can come in a range of different forms. You know, even personality is a system, you know.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting.
The sexual six responds to fear with strength and aggression in some form. So seeing the best defense as a good offense. So they tend to be strong, risk takers and rebellious. They want to sort of be intimidating at all times to keep the enemy at bay. Now, they can also be contrarians and play the devil's advocate a lot. You know, the kind of thing that they'll say the opposite to whatever's just been said just because.
Okay, no. Now I'm starting to wonder if this is where my son hits. He's only like that with us, though. He's not like that with other people.
And strength comes in different forms. So strength can also be beauty, you know, that really beautiful people are intimidating to other people and it keeps them at a distance and at bay.
Mm-hmm.
So it's strength is going to go through a different lens depending on the person and what shows up there. But they, because of, again, that access to anger and being a bit more aggressive, they can be confused for eights.
Okay.
And that just leaves us with the sevens, always the happy time at the end.
The best to last.
End of the process. Sevens core drivers around gluttony, which is really wanting to have a little bit of everything in three different ways. It's not just about food or, you know, consuming, you know, alcohol or whatever as we think about gluttony. It's just wanting a little bit of everything. So the self-preservation seven creates a network of alliances or friends that will always be there to help them get their needs met or help them connect the dots or achieve their goals in some form. So they want to be able to have access to opportunities to get their needs met. They are practical, pragmatic, cheerful, talkative, sometimes very hedonistic, and are very good at getting what they want. However, they have an anxiety underneath that isn't always obvious to other people. So they can seem a little six-ish around that focus on the anxiety and the pragmatism.
Okay.
Social sevens go against self-interest by trying to appear selfless. So they recognize that there's a selfishness to the seven, but that social drive has them trying to go in the opposite direction. So they will take the smallest piece of cake. My self-preservation self always takes the largest piece of cake. I've had to learn to take the smallest piece, but the social seven will take the smallest piece so that they appear selfless to other people. They appear like they're self-sacrificing. So they work really hard to relieve other people's pain in hopes that it also relieves their own without them having to actually touch it. So
I think that this is my mom. I'm seeing my mom here.
Right. And so they often have careers in things like grief counseling or doctors and nurses or pastors because it's about relieving other people's pain, which means they can look a little like twos or nines and sometimes even a little bit like that social eight.
Okay.
The sexual seven is very idealistic and imaginative. They embellish reality so they can live inside this rose-colored glasses fantasy and can be overly enthusiastic, optimistic, and too happy.
Okay, I see that. I see my mom there too.
Well, see, all sevens share that optimism.
Sure.
But it's how does it get expressed? And the sexual seven can be overly optimistic. They can almost have more optimism than the self-preservation seven. I don't consider myself an optimist. That doesn't mean I don't reframe negatives into positives on a regular basis, but I feel like I'm doing that because I see reality being quite painful. And so I almost see the difference. I was having this conversation the other day that the sexual seven might bright side something in the sense of that, you know, here is this terrible. I was talking to a friend and she was worried about losing a job. And I imagine that the sexual seven would say, oh, that would never happen. You'll be fine. My self-preservation self was like, well, if you get fired, you'll get 3 months off. Look at all the great things you can do with that 3 months off. So it's like, yeah, the bad thing's going to happen. But let's look at how we can make the bad thing good.
Oh, yeah. That's more my mom.
So as opposed to pretending it won't happen.
Pretending it won't happen. Yeah. Gotcha.
But I might be doing sexual sevens a disservice there. But But yeah, they're very restless and easily hypnotized. There's a gullibility and naivete to them because they can, that enthusiasm will just sort of bring them in and they will get on that enthusiasm bandwagon. So they can look, you know, at times a little like nine-ish, sometimes a little five-ish, but it's, you know, it just depends on the flavor of everyone's form because I've met many people of the same type now and the core drivers can be the same, but the way they're seeing them and the way those are expressed can still be very different. So you're still not going to have, you know, all self-preservation seven looking like me, you know, and they'll still be driven by, you know, that need to be pragmatic and to get what they want and to have connections to do so. But the flavor in terms of their life experience, you know, and their family and how they've grown up all are going to make it show up a little bit differently.
Yeah. And of course you've got life experience. You've got everything. You've got Myers-Briggs type. You've got everything.
Yeah. So I've been meeting quite a few ENFPs lately. And if they're a seven, it is super obvious.
Yeah. My mom's an ENFP, Enneagram 7. Yeah.
If they're not a seven, it's much harder to figure out. And so, there is a stereotype that plays into it in terms of where we see the Myers-Briggs types lining on the Enneagram, but any type can be any type. It's just that if they don't fall into the stereotype, it just takes longer to narrow down the options and figure out where they fall.
Yeah, I have a friend who's an INTJ Enneagram 7.
Oh, wow.
Isn't that an interesting combo? She was actually on the podcast maybe 4 or 5 episodes ago talking about that unique combo. And we talked about on the podcast, we talked about her struggle with housekeeping from a personality perspective, which is interesting.
Yeah. I've met a few INTJs, often coming up as social 5s, but also a social 3.
Social 3. Oh, okay.
So yeah, we're all different flavors.
Yeah. So can we talk about countertype? What is a countertype?
Great question. Countertype is really where the energy flows in a different direction to what you'd normally expect. So with the social 7, you know, normally the 7s are self-interested, but when you combine it with that social instinct, it's flowing in a different direction. So there's almost like a clash in some way. So that social 7's trying to convince the world that they're actually not selfish, that they're, you know, very selfless. And so it's just something doesn't flow in the same direction in what you'd expect. So the self-preservation 4 is also a countertype because you don't expect that 4 to try and keep all that feeling inside of themselves.
And does every single Enneagram type have a countertype?
Absolutely, yes. So the countertypes are the sexual 1, the self-preservation 2, the self-preservation 3, the self-preservation 4, the sexual 5, the sexual 6, the social 7, the social 8, and the social 9.
Okay. So those are the one of each type that is going to look a bit different than the other two.
Than the norm. Yeah.
And so will you maybe you won't recognize yourself maybe in the common descriptions for those types?
Yeah, definitely. And, or even be a little bit more confused about what your type is. Although, to be honest though, I mean, I'm not a countertype and I can still be confused, you know? So I think it's just a little bit extra hard if you're a countertype to find it. And you need a little bit more support at times.
Yeah. Well, what are you working on right now? What can people come to you for?
The short answer to that is for coaching using the Enneagram and some courses I've developed based on grieving and healing and procrastination, but really breaking our own rules. So I've been setting up this business for a while. So with any personal growth endeavor, it takes time. And so I wanted to create a place that recognized that healing and personal growth are long-term challenges that we work through bit by bit, where we are doing it both alone, but we need other people's support through what can often feel like a constant dark night of the soul type moment where your identity is both breaking apart and reforming all at the same time. And so my business is called Individuo, which is based on, you know, going together, alone together, because it's an individual journey that we need other people's support for. And that's where really people can find me to take one of my courses. So really reframing, understanding grieving, because we all have so much grief, and having a new relationship and a new understanding and building a skill set around grieving, I think is really important. A program around understanding the messages your body's been sending you that contribute to chronic ill health and being able to see that a little more clearly and with more clarity. And also understanding why we try and undermine and self-sabotage ourselves, again, with a program around breaking the rules that keep us hemmed in and procrastinating on things that we actually really care about.
And how do you spell that, Individuo?
INDIVIDUO. It's like individual, but you just have a duo at the end instead.
Okay. And I'll link that in the show notes.
Yeah.
And where else can people find you? Is that the best place or is there?
That's the best place. You can also find a lot of my content I create for Truity at truity.com or on our Truity's YouTube site. I write a lot of articles around the Enneagram. But yeah, individuo.co.nz is where you'll find me and the other side of me. Okay. I work on I'm a 7. My fingers are in lots of pies. I like doing lots of different things, but my real focus now that I've completed my work with Beatrice and Uranio is to be able to provide that Enneagram coaching and group coaching to people because it's just so powerful.
Yeah. And can people just come to you if they just want a, like an Enneagram typing session too?
Absolutely. Yes. And growth pathway. So if you don't want to do full coaching, but you just want to get a sense of what's your type and what should I be working on, mm-hmm. do that as well.
Cool. Well, thanks for coming on. This was super fun. I think people find it really interesting.
It's fascinating. So I hope they do. There's so much to learn about the Enneagram. And I think the final thing really is to say the type is just the beginning. The Enneagram is not about typology per se. It's about deep personal growth. And so if you're just trying to find a type, there's almost no point doing so. It's really, what is that type going to teach you in terms of your own personal journey and transformation?
Okay. I kind of got the tingles there on that last little insight from Samantha. Thank you so much for Samantha's time. That was an incredible amount of information. Please check Samantha out at individuo.co.nz. The link is also in the show notes. She's got courses up there on that website about mapping your health, clearing overlooked grief, and outsmarting procrastination. And like she said, she's doing all that incredible growth coaching regarding Enneagram and typing. And if you're, you know, ready to really dig in and start your growth work through personality type, I mean, Samantha really knows her stuff. And she just has this incredible energy that I can really vouch for because I did a typing session with her and I have had these great conversations with her. And I really recommend that you go and check her out and contact her through her website and see what she can offer you. And you can also check out all the stuff she writes on truity.com. Write in, and I would love to hear your thoughts on today's episode, familypersonalitiespod@gmail.com. Next on the podcast, we're heading back to Myers-Briggs. I have an ENFP-ISTP couple coming on. They have been married for 20 years, and they have 4 kids together, and they have extensive knowledge on Myers-Briggs, and they do not share any cognitive functions in common with one another. They're an extremely different from one another personality-wise. And they talk all about their relationship and how they manage it and parent together. And it's an incredible conversation. I'm really excited for you guys to hear it. That's coming up next. And then after that, we will get back into our cognitive functions conversations and close out with extroverted feeling and introverted feeling. And all that good stuff. Thank you guys for coming along on this journey. Don't forget that you can donate to the podcast. There's a link in the show notes to donate with PayPal, or you can send me a Venmo at SANDRAETH. At the current moment, I don't have the space and capacity to run my business services, and so the podcast is all that I'm doing. And so anything that you can send me helps me run the back end of the podcast, and it would be greatly appreciated. You can follow me on Instagram and Facebook, not currently posting, but planning to eventually. And I'll catch you next time. That's it for our show this week. We would like to apologize to our children, our parents, our spouses,
and anyone else we may have lovingly thrown under the bus this episode.
Thank you for listening, and catch us next time on the Family Personalities Podcast.